shipping it. The lab midterm lab exams, we're still grading them. We'll have them available for you when you come to lab the next time. They'll be there. And so far, so good. So far, so good. Lab test. Oh, the written exam. Oh, well, yeah, I haven't run this through the machine yet. But I looked over the exam as you were turning them in, and I'm pretty happy so far. Pretty happy. Hopefully you will be. Easier than the take-home exams, right? Difference of opinion there, huh? I gotta shut down the line. All right, so we're going to begin the section on cardiovascular histology. Most of this will be a discussion of the microscopic anatomy of arteries, veins, and capillaries, although there is a section at the end that deals with some of the layers of the heart wall. We've already looked at cardiac muscle, so the only thing we have to do is look at three histological layers, or at least talk about the three histological layers that make up the heart. This technically begins the second half, even though we're over half done. This technically begins the section on organ systems or organs. And we talked about a nerve having four tissues. And so the femoral nerve or the sciatic nerve or whatever nerve would have epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nerve, neural tissue in it. Well, that's what we're going to find out now today, that blood vessels, most of them, arteries and veins anyway, arteries and veins have three tissues in them, epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and neural tissue. So as you're looking at an artery in the lab, try to think about where those four tissues might be in that artery. In a nerve, in the muscle tissue in a nerve is the smooth muscle cells in the vessels that supply nutrients within the nerve. So you might find a small arteriole, for example, in a fascicle deep down in the perimysium. There'd be an arteriole there, and that small artery would have a muscle that regulates blood flow. Part of the artery in the nerve. Yeah. Okay, so let's begin then talking about the cardiovascular system. We have to keep in mind that we're going to be looking in the lab. Kind of a pain to do so, but we're going to ask you to look in the lab for the tiniest of all blood vessels, capillaries. We literally have each individual literally has thousands of miles of capillary. You took the capillaries out of an individual's body and laid them end to end, you could go across the United States without any problem. So these are very tiny and packed in very densely in your body. It's almost intuitively. It's almost impossible to intuitively sense the magnitude of these capillaries. We'll have to look at them. Obviously, arteries, as you well know, deliver blood to the capillaries from the heart, and the veins drain the blood back to the heart. But generally, arteries, except for some exceptions, arteries contain highly oxygenated blood. And generally veins contain less less oxygen in the blood because the oxygen's been given up in the capillaries. And so that's what we were looking at here. In this picture, the capillary is dead. The heart's up here somewhere. It's pumping blood through the arteries that are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And then we reach the capillaries where we can experience gas exchange, oxygen, carbon dioxide exchange, and nutrients given to cells. And then the blood returns to the heart through veins. So generally the veins are color-coded blue. Why would they be color-coded blue? What does the blue color represent in the drawings in your textbook? Yes. Low oxygen, deoxygenation. And the red artery?
Oxygenated.
What artery contains low oxygen? Pulmonary artery. Excellent. What vein contains high oxygen? Pulmonary vein. Wow, cool. Very nice. You must be studying this in physiology right now.
Dr. Patterson?
Yes.
When there's a gas exchange going on in the capillaries, how can it then differentiate which was oxygenated and which was deoxygenated to know what to go back to the vein?
In that drawing?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all... what's the word I want to use? Nebulous. And so the artist here has arbitrarily separated this side from that side. The only value to that is that when we think about capillaries and how they're arranged, we realize that at the arterial end of the capillaries, fluid leaves and goes into the tissue space. And at the venous end of the capillary, fluid from the tissue space goes back into the capillary bed. So it's totally arbitrary and inaccurate symbolic drawing. If fluid leaves the arterial end of the capillary and goes into the tissue space, what force is that? That causes that to happen? Hydrostatic pressure from the pumping heart. What force is it that draws water back into the capillary bed at the venous end? Osmotic pressure, right. Kind of a little tentative about that. Osmotic pressure of the blood draws the fluid in. Hydrostatic pressure from the pumping heart forces the fluid out. There's less fluid that goes back in than leaves, or another way of saying it, more fluid leaves the capillary than goes back into the capillary. So where's the excess fluid go? There's a little extra fluid hanging around there, and what's going to drain the excess fluid from around the capillary? Lymphatic vessels, right, lymphatic vessels. Good. We're going to talk a little bit about these pericytes, which look like little leeches hanging on the surface of capillaries and maybe some small venules, but especially around the capillaries. And these little pericytes are undifferentiated mesenchymal cells, so they can become other things. They're a stem cell, in other words. They can't become everything, but they can become an endothelial cell, and they can become a smooth muscle cell, and we don't know what else. So we're going to talk about those four structures in this section on cardiovascular, much less on the heart, because we've already covered a good bit of that already when we talk about cardiac muscle. There's a little section on lymphatics, and we're not even going to ask you to find lymphatics in the lab because they are so, so thin and difficult to identify, and because they're baggy too, they're big and baggy, and they're not tiny little rings like capillaries. But the structure of lymphatics is going to be very, very similar to the structure of a blood capillary. They have a lot in common, with some differences, but a lot in common histologically, microscopically. Look, the structures are very similar. Well, that brings us into some other basic information here. You're studying, at least, are all of you studying heart in physiology now? Not quite yet. Some of you haven't gotten to it yet. Well, those of you that have will realize that as you think about where the heart fits into our cardiovascular system, we realize that the left ventricle, when it contracts, is pushing blood through the aorta. And that aortic blood is going to all of our organs systemically. So sometimes we think about the systemic circulation as the circulation of blood that is pumped by the left ventricle to supply brain and feet and knees and tendons and ligaments and lung and everything to keep all of our cells, tissues, and organs alive. So the systemic circulation passes through the systemic circulation leaving the left ventricle passes through arteries that are getting smaller and smaller and smaller and capillary beds everywhere in our body, and then the systemic circulation then passes into veins, which get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so where is the quote-unquote end of the systemic circulation? As the blood goes back to the heart. Which chamber of the heart receives the systemic circulation? What chamber of the heart up here receives that blood? The right atrium, yes. Right atrium. And then the blood goes into what chamber? Right ventricle. And the right ventricle is the beginning then of what? Now, pulmonary circulation, right ventricle could be considered. Of course, since it's a circular thing, since it's circulation, you can begin anywhere in the circle. But we'll begin with the right ventricle as the pump for the pulmonary circulation. Now, that's pretty simple, isn't it? The blood is passing from the right ventricle to the pulmonary trunk, pulmonary arteries, going into the capillaries of the lung. What's the objective of the pulmonary circulation? To do what with the blood?
Oxygenate
the blood in the capillaries in the lung. So in the capillaries in the lung, let's draw one here. In the capillaries in the lung, which way is the oxygen going? This way or this way? The one on the left or the one on the right? On the left. The oxygen's going into the capillaries in the lung. How about in the systemic circulation? How about the capillaries in my brain and in my fingers and in my muscles and in my spleen and everywhere else? Which way is the oxygen going in the capillaries? Up here, the capillaries of the systemic circulation. Is the oxygen going this way, or is the oxygen going that way? Going what? Going out, isn't it? Why is the oxygen leaving the capillaries? Well, the oxygen's leaving the capillaries to keep our cells alive, huh? To provide oxygen for mitochondria and production of ATP by the electron transport chain. So, respiration in the lung, the oxygen is entering the blood. Respiration in the systemic circulation is oxygen leaving the blood. This is called external respiration. It's the kind of respiration that everybody thinks of as respiration. And this is called internal respiration because the oxygen is supplying our cells internally. This is called external respiration because the oxygen is coming from the external world and going into the bloodstream. Hopefully that'll make sense as we go along. Pulmonary circulation objective, of course, is to oxygenate blood, and the systemic circulation, bringing the blood to capillaries for the oxygen to now leave the blood. One case it enters the blood, the other case it leaves the blood. So those are the story of the right and left ventricle, aren't they? But we have another kind of fancy Dan circulation that is really a variation, kind of a variation of the systemic circulation. A little variation. And here, in a portal circulation, the blood to a capillary bed, the blood that's going from arterial blood into the capillaries here, it does not go directly back to the heart, but goes to a second capillary bed. Capillary bed 1. Capillary bed 2. And then the blood from all of these capillaries then goes back to the heart. You see the difference? In the systemic circulation, in the pulmonary circulation, blood goes to arteries, goes to capillaries, and goes immediately back to the heart. How about a portal circulation? The blood goes to a capillary bed and does not go directly back to the heart, but goes to a second capillary bed somewhere. And of course, the most famous of all is the hepatic portal circulation. So what does that suggest to you? That something's involved. The liver's involved. So where's the first capillary bed? In the capillaries of your small intestine. And in comes the food. In comes the nutrients and the vitamins and the minerals and the products of the French fries and the Big Mac. All coming into the capillary beds of the small intestine. And then a vein drains that capillary bed out of your small intestine. And that vein ultimately is called the portal vein. It's called the hepatic portal vein. Or correctly called the hepatic portal vein. So if the blood's going to the small intestine capillaries through arteries. Systemic circulation. And then the blood in the capillaries receives all this food. And the blood then enters a single vein. It's called the hepatic portal vein. What's going to happen in the liver? What happens to the blood in the portal, single portal vein entering the liver? It breaks up into what? A second capillary bed. So the liver has a bunch of capillaries in it that are the second capillary bed in this process that we drew here. So this is the capillary bed in your small intestine. The portal vein drains the blood into the liver, and there's a second capillary bed in the liver. And then the blood drains back to the right atrium. That's called a portal system. Oh, that was my next question. You're reading my mind. Yeah. So this is oxygenated blood, isn't it? And the blood's passing through the aorta and then through the mesenteric arteries to get to the small intestine. Highly oxygenated blood. It gives up the food. What else is it? I mean, it picks up food. What else does that blood do? It gives up oxygen to keep our small intestine alive. So what's the quality of the blood that's going to the liver then? Tell me the quality of it. What does it have in it? Not a lot of what? Not a lot of oxygen, but a whole lot of what?
Food.
A whole lot of food, low oxygen, high food. Right. And I shouldn't have had it read, should I? to make all of this glue. Okay, so let's move on. That's just kind of basic principles. This is another way of looking at what we've been talking about here for the systemic circulation, beginning here, left ventricle through the aorta, going, sending blood through arteries up to the head, the neck, and arteries into the arm, and arteries into the leg, and arteries into the abdominal organs, and the thoracic organs, and the pelvic organs, and everywhere.
Did you say that the, as the blood travels to the first capillary bed, that that's considered systemic circulation?
Sure, because it's supplying nutrients. It's supplying oxygen to the cells of the small intestine, and it's coming from the left ventricle.
So it's just when it enters the hepatic portal capillaries that it becomes.
Yeah. So now this blood becomes a portal blood. Okay, and look at those pericytes hanging around the surface of the capillaries there. We're going to look at the histology of large arteries and compare them to the histology of medium-sized arteries. And my thing's going dead here. And then we'll compare it with the histology of small arteries. So we have, in histology lingo, we have large arteries to deal with through the microscope. We have these medium-sized ones we have to look at histologically. And we have the small arteries. And the same is true for veins. We have small veins, medium-sized veins, and large veins, but there's not a significant difference. There's not a significant difference in the histology of small, medium, and large veins. So we're not going to deal much with that, and our emphasis is going to be on arteries and, of course, capillaries. If you're thinking about the physiology of the system and trying to integrate it with your understanding of the structure, as you look at the structure of arteries and veins, you can better understand, I think, the physiology of blood flow in the cardiovascular system. For example, structurally, we have one aorta, and then that aorta will branch off, as we saw back here. The aorta has lots of branches coming off. And these are the medium-sized arteries. This is the large one, aorta. These are the medium-sized arteries. And then the medium-sized arteries branch into the organ itself. Right here in this dotted line right there, the artery disappears and enters a muscle, or the artery disappears and enters an organ. And as you're dissecting in gross anatomy class and you're following an artery, all of a sudden that artery disappears because it goes into the organ. And now the only way to follow would be to dissect the organ apart and follow it. These small vessels that enter the organ are called arterioles. What is I-O-L-E, arteriole? What does that I-O-L-E mean in medical lingo?
Small letters.
Means I-O-L-E, not the A-R-T, but the I-O-L-E part of the word. What does that mean?
Small letters.
No, it doesn't mean artery. It means small. I-O-L-E. And how about the artery before it? No, well, it means small artery, but the I-O-L-E means small. And so how about a veinule? What does that mean? Small vein. Except it's not spelled the same way. It's spelled U-L-E-S instead of I-O, but it sounds the same. Small vein, small artery. You're going to be looking for all of these things in the lab in very branch into smaller arterioles, not shown here very well, but arterioles branch into smaller and smaller arterioles until eventually we reach the capillary level. This blood flowing through here, one tube, the aorta, about an inch in diameter, one tube, all that blood in the aorta, one tube of an inch in diameter, has to pass through thousands of miles of capillaries. Thousands of miles of capillaries. So the surface area of the aorta, pretty small. Total surface area of the lumen, pretty small. But as we get to the thousands of miles of capillary, the surface area reaches, as you see right here, almost 5,000 cubic centimeters. That's square centimeters, not cubic. Square centimeters of surface area. And then as the blood returns back to the heart, that surface area drops down to the large vena cava, superior and inferior vena cava, where the blood, the surface area in that vessel is very small. The blood here has to all pass through there because it's a closed system, isn't it? When the heart pumps, the left ventricle pumps, the blood passing through the aorta has to go through these miles and miles and miles of capillaries. What happens to the blood pressure then, close to the heart? The blood pressure in the blood pressure cuff you put on here in the brachial artery, let's say, and you pump it up, and you read the little gauge, and you have your stethoscope down, and you're listening. That pressure in the brachial artery is approximately equal to the pressure in the aorta. When the heart is pumping, the left ventricle is squeezing, and that pressure in the aorta is approximately equivalent to the pressure in the left ventricle. And it's about 100 to 120, let's say. Well, probably 100 would be better, 120 in the ventricle. And so we get a high pressure here in the aorta. What happens as the vessels branch and the surface area increases? Well, the pressure begins to drop till you get to the arterioles and capillaries, and whoop, down the slope you go. And how's the pressure of the blood in the small veins and the medium-sized veins? Small veins, medium-sized veins, and large veins. Small, medium, and large veins. Pressure is almost zero, pretty low in veins. So what do you think how do you think the wall of an artery is? Thick or thin? How do you think the wall of a vein is? Thick or thin? And why is that? Because the vein doesn't have to withstand much pressure. If you've got a high pressure water system that's 200 pounds per square inch, you better darn well have a thick wall to that tube. How about the drain pipes in your house? Not the water supply, but the drain pipes you turn the faucet on. Do they have to have a thick wall? No, there's no pressure in the drain pipes in your house. The gutter drains on the side of the house, thin wall stuff. But the water supply line is thick wall. So you're going to need that information as you go to lab and you decide, am I looking at an artery now or am I looking at a vein? And what would the difference be? You're peering through the microscope now and you're looking down, and that's a blood vessel. Is it artery or vein? What's the difference? Artery has a thicker wall and the vein has a thinner wall. Pretty simple, huh? Well, there's going to be some other things that we have to look at as well. We have to remind ourselves that this capillary here, like all good capillaries, has a basal lamina that completely surrounds the capillary, which I can't draw very well here, can I? But that basal lamina, just like my sleeve here, my sweater, goes all the way around that capillary. I can't draw it very easily here unless I cover up the capillary so you can't see it. And keep in mind that tissue fluid is formed at this capillary level. as the fluid leaves the arterial end of the capillary and returns to the venous end of the capillary. We didn't get to blood, did we? What's plasma in blood? How would you describe plasma? The water phase. Not the cell, but just the water phase. How would you separate plasma from cells in a lab? Spin it in a centrifuge. And all the cells go down the bottom of the tube and the plasma remains on top. Plasma, in terms of volume, and the average individual, if you look at that tube after you pull it out of the centrifuge, here's the top of the top. There's that 100% of the blood now. You've spun it in a centrifuge tube. Which part has higher volume and mass, the plasma or the cells? The plasma. The cells are packed down into about 45% of the volume, and the plasma about 55% of the volume. So when you spin that blood down into a centrifuge tube, and you pack all those cells down at the bottom, they're heavy, aren't they? You spin them, the heavy things go out to the outer edge of the spinner. So what's this 45 represent in clinical lab lingo? It's called the hematocrit. Have you ever had your hematocrit taken? This is what they're doing. Hematocrit of 45. That's pretty normal. How about if you go to the doctor because, man, am I tired. I can't make it through the day. I fall asleep in Rich Fredrickson's Tuesday evening class. 4 to 6. Former anyway, but man, I can't hardly get up in the morning. And so I'm going to go to the doctor. And would your hematocrit possibly be 20 or 60? Which of those two? You're tired because you got actually iron deficiency anemia. Would your hematocrit be 20 or 60? 20. Your blood cells are packed down into 20% of the volume, and the plasma now becomes 80% of the volume. And how are you going to go through the day if only 20% of your blood is red cells instead of the 45% it should be? So the hematocrit is low, isn't it? And a hematocrit of this level would be called what? Anemia. How about you go into have an annual physical and you knew something was wrong, and the lab results come back, and on that little sheet of paper says your hematocrit is 60. What does that mean then? Means it's too high. It means that 60% of your blood is blood cells rather than the normal 45%. And too many cells can plug up the capillary. Your blood is like molasses. High viscosity. This is not good. This is called polycythemia. Polycythemia. We'll talk about those in detail in pathology class. But I just wanted to get you to think about the blood that has to pass through the tubes.
How do you distinguish between red blood cells and white blood cells when they're doing class?
When you spin out the sample, when you put the sample of blood in the tube and put it in a centrifuge, and you check out the plasma versus cells, you'll find a little thin coating right here at the cell level that represents about 1% of the blood cells. And that little thin scum on the surface of that water is white. Why are white blood cells called white blood cells even though they're not white? They're called white blood cells because this region of the centrifuge tube has a little white scum on it, which represents the white blood cells. Why they appear white in this procedure, no one knows. White blood cells were called white blood cells because of this very thing right here. And if you look at them on the microscope slide, they're anything but white. They're stained with hematoxylin. They're really dark. They're dark cells. The risk there is heart attacks, strokes, infarcts in the spleen, the capillaries get plugged and can't get oxygen in that area.
So they can't get oxygen
when
they don't do the capillaries?
No, because the plugging up of the capillaries only occurs locally. All the rest of the body is just fine. You might have a heart attack at one point in time and then have a stroke a little later. So they don't all plug up at the same time in case you're tired.
Another question. What's the cutoff for anemia? Like,
it depends upon whether you're male or female, and we can't go through that. It depends on whether you're a baby, because the normal hematocrit range in a baby differs from that of an adult, and male differs from female. Why is the a normal hematocrit in a female generally lower than the normal hematocrit in a male? Because they have something called the menstrual period. They're constantly losing blood and blood cells every month, and it takes a while to build up. So you should really consider that as, it's not the only explanation, but it's something you can hang your hat on. No, in clinical lab. All the white blood cells and, in fact, the red blood cell stuff will be talked about in clinical lab.
Can I ask now, how is a white blood cell different from a macrophage? Or is it macrophage?
A macrophage is, the only time you use the term macrophage is when the cell is not in the bloodstream. And in the bloodstream, the cell is called a monocyte, but it's in the bloodstream. And it looks very different than the macrophage. So the monocyte in the blood, in the capillary, the monocyte is not, this is way too big, but the monocyte is a very blah-looking cell with a bean-shaped nucleus. Monocyte. And then when inflammation occurs, that monocyte leaves and goes into the tissue space and becomes a very angry macrophage. Very different looking cell. Let's quickly go into the histology here. Think about why we have blood and why we have blood vessels. We need blood to provide nutrition to our cells. We need blood to deliver oxygen and take away the carbon dioxide. By the way, let's not get confused with respiration here, because that term can be confusing since it's used rather indiscriminately. What's this process called? That's called breathing. Not called respiration. It's called ventilation by Harold. Ventilation or breathing. What's respiration technically? The yes, the exchange of oxygen carbon dioxide between the blood and the tissue space. And so respiration can occur in the capillaries in the lung. I'll tell you one thing, if I'm not breathing, if I'm not doing that, I can't engage in respiration either. So respiration occurs in either the capillaries in the lung or systemic capillaries, and the direction of oxygen flow is different in the lung capillaries than another. We also have to get rid of the waste material, don't we? The byproducts of our cellular metabolism. So, how did the oxygen get in the blood? Tell me that. Where did that happen? In the lungs because of breathing. In the lungs because of breathing. And where does waste removal occur from the blood? A lot of places, but where's the most famous waste removal organ? Kidney. So you get stuff in the blood that has to be carried to the kidney. We can also remove waste in the liver, detoxification process in the liver. But the kidney is the chief waste removal organ.
And the lungs, too, right?
And the lungs. Lungs, skin, lungs, liver. But kidney is the big one. And, of course, as we've spent 2 weeks in pathology talking about this process here called inflammation. Inflammation is a reaction of the capillaries. Inflammation is a reaction of these capillaries up here to cell injury from some sort. All kinds of ways we can injure cells. And in inflammation, whether it be inside of our body, deep in our chest, or deep in our belly, or whether it be on the skin, the same thing happens. This area where the capillaries are responding to cell injury, that area will be red, will be painful, will be swollen, and will be warm. And if you have a blackberry thorn in your finger, that area will hurt, pain. It'll be red, be warm, and it'll be swollen. That's the four cardinal signs of inflammation, which is a response of the microcirculation, the tiny little blood vessels, to cell injury. This is absolutely essential to our survival. If capillaries and cardiovascular system cannot provide inflammation for us, we will die in short order. And of course, without inflammation, pharmaceutical companies can't make big bucks either. So that part of it. Remember this? A long time ago, the tissue space, capillaries here, tissue space there. Review the boundaries of the tissue space. One of the boundaries is the basal lamina of endothelial cells, basal lamina of endothelial cells, and the other is the basal lamina of the external epithelium. Here again, look, there's a capillary, tissue space, epithelium facing the outside world. Here's the epithelium facing the blood, and that's the endothelial cell. A lymphatic vessel also has very similar structure. It's got an endothelial cell, and it's got a puny basal lamina. Almost impossible to see. It turns out that every blood vessel has endothelium. Every blood vessel has simple squamous epithelium, whether it be an artery, a vein, or a capillary. That's the one thing that all blood vessels have in common. And that one thing is a simple squamous epithelial cell in contact with the blood. All right, let's talk about these capillaries. The capillary, as we saw in the drawing here, has a basal lamina on the outside. I didn't label that, did I? black here is a basal lamina, and the red was endothelium. That was the answer to number 12 on the lab exam. Endothelium. The pointer on endothelium. Remember that? I took other answers, however. It turns out that endothelial cells, being simple squamous epithelium, has the ability, because they're touching one another, has the ability to make various types of cell junctions. And the only cell junction that we're going to deal with that found in some capillaries, is the tight junction. And zonuloclutens, it was called. Zonuloclutens. It's the main cell junction found in some capillaries. The average diameter of these capillaries can range from anywhere between 5 to 10 micrometers. That's an interesting measurement, because this capillary, if the luminal diameter If the luminal diameter is less than 7 micrometers, say that's less than 7 micrometers, let's say it's 6 micrometers, then how are you going to get this red blood cell through that capillary if the red blood cell diameter is 7.5 microns? And there's, believe it or not, there's still a debate about what the normal size of a red blood cell should be. But we're going to use the textbook number of 7.5 microns. So how are you going to get a 7.5 micron, 7.5 micron red blood cell through a tube that might be D equals 6 micrometers, because some capillaries are that small? So what do you think happens? The red blood cell has to fold. It has to deform, like that little mouse that runs under the door. How in the world did that mouse get under that door? It's this tall, and the door crack is that high. Yeah, it has to bend and deform. But not all capillaries are that small. 1,000 micrometers equals 1 millimeter. Does that help? 1,000 micrometers equals 1 millimeter. Here's a drawing of a capillary and the endothelial cell junction. The endothelial cell junction is right here. Right there. And here's another one here. And so here's one cell. Here's another cell. Here's a third cell. Here's a nucleus bulging like the yolk of an egg. These are like fried eggs in the frying pan turned into a tube. Lay all the eggs in the frying pan, you take them, and then you roll them up into a tube. And that's what happens here in the capillaries and in all of the blood vessels. And so here's another cell that looks to me like number 4 here on the backside. What's this sleeve that wraps around and touches the plasma membrane of the endothelial cell? Well, you see it up off the top of the screen there? It's the endothelial basal lamina. This structure of the basal lamina plus the endothelial cell is called, by many people, called the vascular membrane. Called the vascular membrane. combination of the endothelial cell and its basal lamina. This vascular membrane combination is found in all vessels, arteries, veins, and here the capillary. What are these little dark areas, do you think? Well, they're called fenestri, but what do you think they might represent? They could represent a hole, but generally they represent a very, very thin spot in the endothelium. The more of these thin spots, the greater the exchange of food and nutrients and gases. The thinner we can make the cell, cytoplasm, the more rapid the transfer is. Here we can see these simple squamous cells all laid out flat. Cut the tube and lay it out flat instead of a round tube now, and you can see the cell communications. This is truly an epithelium. Here are some junctional complexes. Generally, those are tight junctions. There's tight junctions in here. What does that imply? That some capillaries, some endothelial cells have tight junctions. What does that create? A situation where what? Nothing can pass through those joints. You can't pass anything through a tight junction. That's the reason why we're talking about tight junctions all the time. You can't get stuff to go between the cells very easily.
How are the other cells connected? How else are they connected besides tight junctions?
Besides junctions, we're going to see that in a second. There's three types of capillaries. One type has tight junctions, and there are other two types that don't. We'll hold on to that. Here's some of the junctional complexes, tight junction. Here's some others there. Not all capillaries have tight junctions. Two other types that don't. What this shows is that if you can't get things between the cell, then how are you going to get it across from the blood to the tissue space, from the blood to the hungry cell? Well, there's a ferry system of pinocytotic vesicles that will grab things and will carry them across the cytoplasm and dump them out on the other side of the capillary. That's one way. Fat-soluble things don't have to take that route. Fat-soluble stuff can just pass right through the cytoplasm. Pass directly through the cytoplasm. The diffusion rate is slower, but still can diffuse. But endothelial cells, capillaries, have these little pinocytotic vesicles that help. Capillaries also have this thing called a Weibel-Palade body that's not found in any other cells. Weibel-Palade body. These guys shared the Nobel Prize. George Palade. I don't remember what Weibel's first name was. These objects contain a blood clotting protein called a von Willebrand factor. Von Willebrand blood clotting factor. Most of this blood clotting factor, von Willebrand, is made in endothelial cells. The most common genetic blood clotting disease is not hemophilia, but it's called von Willebrand disease, where the individuals cannot clot the blood very easily because there's an absence or a deficiency of Weibel-Palade bodies in their endothelial cell. They're born with that genetic deficiency. Most of that blood clotting factor is made in the endothelial cell and stored there and ready to use. This von Willebrand factor binds blood platelets to make a blood clot. We'll bind blood platelets to initiate a clot formation. One more slide, then we'll take a break here. Now we're getting to the three types of capillaries related to your question here. We have three major types based upon size and whether they have tight junctions or not. And the first one is the capillary that has a tight junction between endothelial cells. And its name does not tell you anything about it, as far as I'm concerned. It's a crappy name, not helpful to the student, and it's called a continuous capillary. The next capillary, generally a little bit larger, is called a fenestrated capillary because this capillary doesn't have tight junctions, but it does have lots of these fenestrations. They're not exactly a hole, but they're a super duper thin spot. And so a fenestrated capillary is much more likely to transport quicker. Tight junction or continuous capillaries are found in the brain. We have to make sure that in the brain we don't have random stuff going in and destroying our neurons. So we have a blood-brain barrier. And so these continuous capillaries and the astrocytes in the brain team up to form a blood-brain barrier. Fenestrated capillaries are found in the kidney, where we want to make sure that the kidney gets rid of all kinds of waste material very rapidly so this person doesn't have to go on dialysis. The capillaries and the glomeruli and the renal corpuscles that you saw that are internal to Bowman's capsule, and where you're looking for simple squamous epithelium, those capillaries in that structure have lots of fenestrations in them. And then the most rapid transport of all are in these larger capillaries called sinusoidal capillaries. And here there are gross holes in the endothelium. Not big enough for blood cells to get out. Thank goodness. White cells, red cells don't get out because they're not that big. But they're pretty good size, and so fluid can exit quite rapidly. And I guess since we're talking about this, we better look at them before we go on break. So let's look at these three types of capillaries. This looks like there's fenestrations there, and I'm sorry about that. But anyway, here's a capillary. You can see the endothelial cell. It's got tight junctions. These are really pinocytotic vesicles. They're not the fenestrations, so don't confuse these little holes with those. Fenestrations are a larger diameter. These are the pinocytotic vesicles that we saw right here. And so the artist drew them in, and that only created confusion. What's the blue on the outside? Basement membrane, basal lamina. And if you have to cut a hole in the basal lamina to see the endothelial cell. There's a red cell. Here's a fenestrated capillary. Now we have some really, really super duper thin spots. Not a hole, but just a thin spot. And so things can diffuse through these thin spots quite readily. And we'll find these capillaries in the kidney, renal corpus in the kidney. What about this sinusoidal capillary? Looks like it's moth-eaten. Looks like somebody took a shotgun and shot holes in the thing. And this is a little bigger, too. Notice the diameter is a little bigger. Now, these sinusoidal capillaries, I think you probably can tell by looking at them, they exchange stuff very rapidly. The red cells can't quite get out through those holes, though, and the white cells can't either. But nutrients and plasma, boy, it leaves the blood pronto. And thank God that we have sinusoidal capillaries in our liver. Because I want all that food absorbed in my gut to get to the liver cells as fast as I can get it. And the sinusoidal capillaries have just the right structures to allow the nutrients to gush out of the capillaries and are picked up by liver cells. Which capillaries? don't penetrate. No. So that's why that saying is misleading. Those little holes there are not holes at all. They're the pinocytotic vesicle. So that's confusing. Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me. It would appear that the capillaries in the liver, the sinusoidal capillaries in the liver, lack a basal lamina. And that even encourages more flow through the hole, doesn't it? If we don't have Mr. Coffee filter there in the way, then we can get through things through much, much more quickly. Well, it turns out that some of the ingredients of a basal lamina are, in fact, around the capillary, even though we can't see it with the electron microscope. So if you did a biochemical study of the surface of this sinusoidal epithelium, you would find type 4 collagen there. You'd find type 4 collagen there, but it lacks other things that would allow you to see the structure. So part of the basal lamina material is there, but we can't see it. So I don't know what that means exactly. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll look at each of these capillaries in a little more detail. This egg that's lying flat in your flying pad could curl up and could touch on the other side. That could be just one cell, or it could be multiple cells. It's probably multiple cells because I think there's another junction right here. And the parasite in the drawing here is a stem cell located actually within the basal lamina of the endothelial cell. That basal lamina, showing as this fuzzy coat here, actually splits to surround this parasite, and the parasite becomes embedded in that endothelial basal lamina. And so basal lamina would not only be here next to the endothelium, but the basal lamina would also be out here covering that parasite stem cell. Here's a fenestrated capillary like we'd find in the kidney. And the arrows are pointing at these thin spots called the fenestrations. This is a cytoplasm of the endothelial cell. Here's some more cytoplasm and some more cytoplasm with the cell membrane, phospholipid bilayer. Here's some cytoplasm here. Same thing down here. And these arrows are pointing at super thin spots in the endothelial cell, however, not a hole because there's a little diaphragm. There's a little diaphragm across that hole. And after all, that little diaphragm represents a window. A window. A little window to peer through fenestration. Little glass window. Actually, that tissue there is up for grabs. We're still trying to figure out what that tissue is composed of, but it's probably glycocalyx, probably the fuzzy coat of the cell. Anyway, there's no plasma membrane where those arrows are pointing. There's no phospholipid bilayer there. It's some other kind of cell surface tissue. this capillary can transfer stuff in and out of it very, very quickly. I don't have a sinusoidal capillary to show you, but I can make one here for you. Let's make a sinusoidal capillary out of this one. All we got to do is make some holes. That's a perfect, beautiful, I'll grab and break my hand now. Beautiful sinusoidal capillary. But the holes were very rapid. There's no window there. There's no diaphragm across those holes. Continuum. Liver capillary. Spleen. Capillaries in the spleen. The capillary in bone marrow. Spleen, bone marrow, and liver. So, what is this vascular membrane endothelium plus basal lamin all about? Well, it allows for permeability changes. Just the anatomy of it will determine its permeability. Continuous capillary has generally less permeability to it, but the permeability can be changed. For example, endothelial cells can contract, and when endothelial cells contract, it opens up gaps here where a cell, a white blood cell, may pass through this hole. And so increasing permeability of capillaries is the basis for inflammation, where cells in the blood go out and kill bacteria, where neutrophils and macrophages leave the bloodstream through these holes, because the endothelial cell can alter its permeability and allow some of the cells to get out. The endothelial cells can contract, which opens up these holes. As the cell contracts, the holes appear. Endothelial cells can undergo mitosis, and so you can form new capillaries whenever necessary. And that neovascularization occurs every month in the female that has a menstrual cycle. The lining, part of the lining of the uterus sloughs off, and now it has to regrow, and we got to regrow new capillaries. Endothelial cells undergo mitosis, and we grow new capillaries every month. The endothelial cells, when necessary, can release von Willebrand factor and initiate a blood clot. The von Willebrand factor that was kept in the Weibel-Pilati bodies could cause platelets to stick to a spot where the endothelial cell thinks we need some reinforcement. And of course, inflammation is a property which includes permeability changes, includes contractility. Those two up above there are part of inflammation. Inflammation, again, is a response of the microcirculation, the response of endothelial cells to some cell injury out in the tissue space. And what happens is cells, white blood cells leave, neutrophils and monocytes leave the bloodstream to go out and kill bacteria or to remove dead cells. And through those holes, we get a bunch of chemicals that we'll talk about next year in inflammation. Capillary beds take a bunch of individual capillary profiles and put them all together and make a capillary bed. And capillary beds are provided with blood through the tiniest arteriole. And this small artery, how do I know it's a small artery? Because I see the word small here, I-O-L-E, small artery, is the artery that delivers the blood directly to the capillary, so we'll call it the before the capillary small artery, or pre-capillary arteriole. And the vein that drains blood away from the capillary bed to send it back to the heart for the pulmonary circulation is called after the capillary bed, post-capillary little vein, veinule, little vein. And then, of course, sometimes the arteriole and the veinule bring blood to a bypass route that doesn't go into the capillary. And we call these arteriovenous shunts and go by a bunch of different names. So let's think about that a little bit. That would be like having Interstate 405 running north and south. Interstate 405 is over here. Interstate 5 is over here. And here's the 520 bridge right there. It's not a good analogy. Let's take another city besides Seattle. Let's take Columbus, Ohio, where you have freeways running north and south and another freeway interconnecting them. Well, you can get off the freeway on ramps and go into the streets of Columbus, which is a pain in the neck. The capillary beds, the streets of downtown Columbus. Well, the blood flowing through here can go through the capillary bed, or the blood can take the bypass route and not go through the streets of the city. It's called the shunt, arteriovenous shunt. Here's the pre-capillary arteriole in the wrong color. Here's the post-capillary veinule in the correct color. And we can shunt blood past capillary bed. Oh, here's another analogy. When you go to Midwest cities, President Eisenhower decided that we had to have these truck routes around the outside of the city. You ever been to a city like that where they have these? Columbus, Ohio has them, Indianapolis, Minneapolis. Well, these bypass routes where they put the truckers. That's the shunt, so that the trucks and the vehicles don't have to pass through the streets of the city or the capillary. I got a better drawing here in a minute. Here are some other names for this arteriovenous shunt. Metarterial, you'll see that commonly in a physiology drawing. I just simply like to call it a thoroughfare, a four-lane highway. And in order to make this work to distribute blood into the streets of the city, or to make sure that the blood bypasses the streets, we have to have some sphincters. What's a sphincter? Something that constricts down, doesn't it? And so what cell type? What type of muscle cell would we find in a capillary that would be a sphincter? Cardiac, skeletal, or smooth muscle, right? Smooth muscles. Skeletal muscles are in moving our bones. Cardiac muscle beats the heart. Smooth muscle every place else. That's going to be a smooth muscle there. And this whole unit of precapillary arteriole, postcapillary veinule, and the capillary beds and the shunts are called our microcirculation of our body. Microcirculation includes this arteriole here, this veinule here, this shunt here, plus all the capillaries. That's not our macro circulation. That's our micro circulation.
Can you show on that drawing where the capillary
sphincter
would be?
Let me show it up here first, okay. And then we'll go back to this one. I've made that so hastily that it's going to be four. The sphincters, the green arrow there, the sphincters are right here. So we can close down that opening into the capillary there. There's a sphincter here, right there. So there's various sphincters that can close off or open up.
Can you make a different color?
Can't see that. Oh, good. I can't see it either. Why am I doing it? Okay, how about that? There's a little smooth muscle cell right there. Right there, and right there. And there are far more of them here than are drawn on. But they're just suffice it to say that they are strategically located to open and close capillaries. And I can see in the artist's drawing here, if this smooth muscle Colgate were to close here by contracting, the blood could no longer flow through that capillary bed, but instead would go through this shunt here. And so let's follow that shunt. Precapillary arteriole, down the shunt. By the way, very little oxygen is getting to our cells now. And now we have reached, and you can't see it anymore, I've reached the venule. But by going through that root in blue there, the blood has not gone into the capillaries to provide nutrition and oxygen to our cell, or very little. Why do we have these? Well, let's say that this capillary bed here is in your muscles of your leg. And now you want to run the Boston Marathon. What do you want your sphincters to do?
Open
so the blood goes through the capillary, right? And now, I'm done running the Boston Marathon. So do I want all that blood to go to my muscles? What's going to happen? The sphincters accommodate by closing off the flow into the capillaries. And so we can use the blood for other things, like dreaming. Or watching the Steelers win the football game Monday night. Oh, so great. Yeah, so in other words, depending upon the metabolic needs of the body, the sphincters work to open and close the capillary beds, so you get more or less blood flow. And in physiology, you'll refer to this in physiology as the percentage of the cardiac output. Percentage of the cardiac output that goes to the capillaries of any particular organ at any particular time, depending upon the metabolic needs of that. How about the brain? Got capillaries in the brain. You think there's a whole lot of sphincters there?
No.
Not many. The brain has an ability to shunt blood to areas that are being used at any particular time. Otherwise, the PET scan wouldn't work. Otherwise, we wouldn't get any information from a PET scan. However, there isn't very much of this, because we want to have a constant blood flow to our brain at all times, because it's always working. Well, almost always working. Except on exams, it's not cooperating. It's almost always working. What are these green tubes here?
Lymphatic
vessels to drain away excess fluid that accumulates in the tissue space. And then review this again. I have it in there twice, just to emphasize for impact. Here's a different author's view of this. Here's an arteriole. There's the capillary bed. Here's some sphincters which can close off. Now, if these sphincters close off up here, but they remain open here, then we reduce the flow into that capillary bed by how much? About
half.
We reduce the blood flow by half. Now, if there were sphincters here that closed off as well, then how would the blood get over to the venule then? Right down here. Through the med arteriole, through the bypass route, to the truck route.
Are they really completely closing?
Not really. The question is, do they really totally prevent blood flow? Not likely. They just reduce the flow, not totally close it off like I implied. Otherwise, there would be some cells that would be hurting and suffering. Capillaries in the heart. Look at your cardiac muscle slide in lab. See if you can find these tiny little rings. Here's the cross section of cardiac muscle cell. Unfortunately, the nuclei don't show up very well. There's one right there. But you have a slide of heart that shows capillaries quite nicely. You still have to look hard because in other slides that you've got, when the tissue's processed, the capillaries are so thin. Capillaries are so thin that when the tissue is processed, they just get slammed shut. And if you can't see a little ring, then you don't know what you're looking at, do you? So capillaries are not easy to see if they're squished in the processing. So you're not going to always see them. You can see them in the kidney slides, and you can see them in this heart slide. Here's a capillary drawn by me a long time ago there. And you can see the basal lamina around the outside. And in order to make arteries or veins, all that's necessary is to add some layers. Add some layers to the outside. And so those layers include smooth muscle cells, which wrap around the vascular membrane. You see, this could be a capillary up here. This could be a venule or arterial down here, because now we've added to the basic common denominator, we've added some smooth muscle cells, we've added some fibroblasts, we've added some collagen and elastic fibers, we've added connective tissue, and we've added smooth muscle cells going from here to here. And so this is a slide which shows some of those ingredients. We have added a fibroblast here, and some connective tissue material there, and there's a smooth muscle cell to make something that works for us. Arteries, then. We've been spending a lot of time talking about capillaries. Let's see what changes in making an artery. Obviously, this lumen is way too small. This is not a very accurate model. That hole's too tiny there. But you get the idea that the size of the lumen is much smaller than the width of the wall. So we have small, less than 1 millimeter in diameter, and generally, if we were really persnickety about it, we could have you count the number of smooth muscle cell layers. You can do it. You mean very often anal? Being very anal about it? Persnickety, that's a good word. Well, how did I? See, my mother used to say it all the time. All these words come out of my mouth because of my mother. I don't remember what it means either. I know I use it. But. Anyway. There, a tube, an artery that has only 5 to 6 layers of smooth muscle cells or less, is an arteriole, technically. Muscular arteries are the ones that are tagged in the gross anatomy lab exam. The ones with little strings around them with a little tag that says number something or other. In other words, these are the distributing arteries that you can dissect out of the cadaver, and you're distributing blood to the vessel that you can't see. As you follow this artery in the leg, I can't remember. Artery in the leg going to a muscle, all of a sudden that artery disappears. And that artery and the continuation of it is an arteriole, generally. So these are named vessels. Brachial artery, femoral artery, popliteal artery, anterior tibial. Is there an anterior tibial? I don't know. Yeah. Is there one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then we have these elastic arteries, which are few in number, and the aorta is the best example. But also, the pulmonary trunk. The two big arteries that leave the heart, that are attached to the heart, and the blood is leaving the left ventricle and leaving the right ventricle, these two, anybody have any idea why they might be called elastic arteries? If you're a physiologist, why would they be called elastic arteries? Because they can have a lot of recoil. If you're a histologist, why are they called elastic arteries? Because they're loaded with elastic fiber, right? Depends on your perspective, doesn't it? They're elastic recoil because they have elastic fibers by the gobs. I know what a gob means. It's a lot. Basic organization of all of these arteries is coming up now. There's a basic plan. And they all have a vascular membrane in the center next to the blood. That's the endothelium and its basal lamina. And outside of that is an elastic membrane called the internal elastic membrane. This is on the outside of it now. We're going from center to outward. And then the next layer out is called the tunica media. What does that mean? Tunic. What's tunic? A covering. A layer. A covering layer. How about media? The middle. Middle layer. Smooth muscle is concentrated here. Here's where the smooth muscle is. For all arteries and veins. And veins. And if you're the aorta, you've got a gob of elastic fiber. A lot of elastic if you're the aorta. Now, if you're the tibial artery, you don't have too many elastic fibers because you're a muscular artery, not an elastic artery. A lot of collagenous fibers there too, but the principal component is smooth muscle cells in layers. What's the function of these? What's the function of these smooth muscle cells right here? What's the function of those smooth muscle cells that wrap around that tube? Collapse the lumen down. Vasoconstrict. And what happens after they vasoconstrict generally? And they vasorelax. No, they dilate. So they're going to change blood flow and alter blood pressure, aren't they? Blood flow and blood pressure are altered by that layer. The tunica adventitia is the outside layer, and it has a lot of loose connective tissue, areolar connective tissue, a lot of nerves, and a lot of capillaries in that outside coat, which is a little hairy, like my sweater here. A lot of little hairs. These are collagen fibers sticking out from that outside layer. This combination of things here is sometimes called the tunica intima. Intimate. The internal layer. So there's three layers, three tunics, and tunica intima, tunica media, and tunica adventitia.
And this is the connective tissue layer, the basal lamina?
Basal lamina belongs to the vascular membrane there. The endothelium and its basal lamina. Some people do not include the internal elastic membrane in the tunica intima. And I'm generally of that type. I kind of leave this one separate, and then the tunica intima would be equivalent to the vascular membrane. So it depends on your textbook. I generally describe the internal elastic membrane as an elastic layer that separates the intima from the media. That's how I have it here. internal elastic membrane separating the intima from the media. And so that's the tunic intima. And let's look at it. Beginning over here with the endothelium, unfortunately, the artist felt that they could not put the basal lamina on there because then you wouldn't see the endothelial cell. So the basal lamina has been excluded from the drawing. And that's tunica intima, the endothelial cell and the basal lamina. And then there's an internal elastic layer that isn't completely solid, is it? It's got little holes in it. But it's elastic fibers, nevertheless. And then outside of that is the tunica media, smooth muscle cells. And then outside of that is the tunica adventitia. So let's do that again. The blood is touching the tunica intima. It's separated from the smooth muscle cells by the internal elastic membrane. And then outside of the tunica media is the tunica adventitia, which is mostly connective tissue. Mostly connective tissue. Mostly smooth muscle. Media, smooth muscle. Adventitia, connective tissue. Here's a scanning electron micrograph, and the only reason I'm really showing this special image is that the internal elastic membrane recoils at the time of death. And so at the time of death, this internal elastic membrane, because of its recoiling, because everything recoils inward as the blood leaves, the vessel, the internal elastic membrane becomes convoluted. And that's how you're going to see it in the lab, as this wiggly, squiggly kind of thing, which I guess you've already seen, really. How are you going to see that elastic membrane in the histological slides? What do you have to do to the tissue in order for you to see it? You have to stain it with a special elastic fiber stain, don't you? And so here it hasn't been stained, but the artist drew it in anyway. And you can see the internal elastic membrane is a squiggly, recoiled elastic membrane. The intima is on the inside. The media is a smooth muscle cell. And the adventitia is really hard to distinguish. Here's a vein over here. There's another comparable vein. Right here, vein, and over here, artery. Notice the vein. What do you notice about the vein in addition to the fact that it's thin-walled? It doesn't have any squiggly in it. What can't you see in the vein? The internal elastic membrane cannot be seen. There's fibers there, but it lacks the squiggly. And that's about as useful as all get out when test time comes around and the pointer's on a vein or the pointer's on an artery. Small arteries, arterioles, they have 5 or 6 layers of smooth muscle cells. Here's the electron microscopic image of that. Still has an endothelial cell. There's an arteriole. I count 1, 2, 3 layers of smooth muscle, maybe 2 layers. Arteriole, very small number of smooth muscle cells. How do I know that's a smooth muscle cell there? Long what? Long cucumber-shaped nucleus. Long, long nucleus there. And there's another small arteriole here. Compare the venule and the arteriole. What characteristics help you identify this as a small vein as opposed to this one, which is a small artery? What do you see that you're going to use when you go to lab? What's the difference in the luminal size? Vein has a very large lumen and a thin wall. Artery has a thick wall and a small lumen. Pressure, isn't it? Pressure gradient. Here's a drawing of a muscular artery. Now, you do have a slide where the internal elastic membrane is staining with an elastic fiber stain, and that squiggly zone there, internal elastic laminar membrane, will be colored black. And I think you looked at that slide when you were trying to find simple squamous epithelium, and the intense blackness of it prevented you from really seeing the simple squamous endothelial cell. Notice a very important compartment here, which is part of the tunica intima. It's connective tissue located between the simple squamous endothelial cell layer. It's a loose connective tissue zone between the endothelial cell layer and Mr. Squiggly, the internal elastic membrane. This zone, called subendothelium, has become supremely important in our understanding of atherosclerosis because it's right there, at that spot, that atherosclerosis develops in the subendothelial connective tissue of the tunica intima. And so vessels that have a large subendothelial compartment develop atherosclerotic plaques. Well, in muscular arteries, that region is so small that for some reason or another, it's so small that atherosclerosis never develops in muscular arteries at all. So my arm, a person with atherosclerosis would have no lesions in the arm, because the lesions are primarily in large elastic arteries, like the aorta, and the exception would be the coronary arteries. Right in here, the artist has magnified that area to emphasize the subendothelial connective tissue. That space is huge in the aorta, and it's huge in the coronary arteries, and it's huge in the vessels of the head, and we have to stop. Yes, question? Hardening of the arteries is called hardening. Athero is artery, and sclerosis means hard. Atherosclerosis, artery hard, or hardening of the artery. We'll have to stop, and we'll come back. Oh, I just want to show you the aorta here. Let me draw in the endothelial cells right up here. They're in the internal layer here, and the internal elastic membrane is down here. And so in the aorta, we have this spacious compartment where all this crappy fat from our diet and all these oxidized LDLs and smooth muscle cells and all the bad things that result from our lifestyle get deposited in that subendothelial connective tissue. In other words, never will we find lesions in the tunica media. Never find damage to the tunica adventitia. The lesions develop in the tunica intima and the subendothelial connective tissue, and as this plaque grows, it bulges into the lumen, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It is all fat and junk, and all of the parts of our lesion until there's no blood flow through that artery anymore. And that person then has a heart attack. So we have a little bit more to do with arteries. And next time, make sure you're prepared also for the immune system, because we're going to talk about lymph nodes, spleen, and thymus next time as well.